This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. I'll be reading again today from A Sand County Almanac by Aldo Leopold, published in 1948. And I thank the Aldo Leopold Foundation for permission to read this book. This is the December chapter. The first part is called Home Range, and the second part is called Pines Above the Snow. The wild things that live on my farm are reluctant to tell me, in so many words, how much of my township is included within their daily or nightly beat. I'm curious about this, for it gives me the ratio between the size of their universe and the size of mine, and it conveniently begs the much more important question, who is the more thoroughly acquainted with the world in which he lives? Like people, my animals frequently disclose by their actions what they decline to divulge in words. It is difficult to predict when and how one of these disclosures will come to light. The dog, being no hand with an axe, is free to hunt while the rest of us are making wood. A sudden yip, yip, yip gives us notice that a rabbit flushed from his bed in the grass is headed elsewhere in a hurry. He makes a beeline for a woodpile a quarter mile distant, where he ducks between two corded stacks, a safe gunshot ahead of his pursuer. The dog, after leaving a few symbolic tooth marks on the hard oak, gives it up and resumes his search for some less canny cottontail, and we resume our chopping. This little episode tells me that this rabbit is familiar with all of the ground between his bed in the meadow and his blitz cellar under the woodpile. How else the beeline? The rabbit's home range is at least a quarter mile in extent. The chickadees that visit our feeding station are trapped and banded each winter. Some of our neighbors also feed chickadees, but none band them. By noticing the furthest points from my feeder at which banded chickadees are seen, we have learned that the home range of our flock is half a mile across in winter, but that it includes only areas protected from wind. In summer, when the flock has dispersed for nesting, banded birds are seen at greater distances, often mated with unbanded birds. At this season, the chickadees pay no heed to wind, often being found in opened, windswept places. The fresh tracks of three deer, clear in yesterday's snow, pass through our woods. I follow the tracks backward and find a cluster of three beds, clear of snow, in the big willow thicket on the sandbar. I then follow the tracks forward. They lead to my neighbor's cornfield, where the deer have pawed waste corn out of the snow and also tussled one of the shucks. The tracks then lead back by another route to the sandbar. In route, the deer have pawed at some grass tufts, nuzzling for the tender green sprouts within, and they have also drunk at a spring. My picture of the night's routine is complete. The overall distance from bed to breakfast is a mile. Our woods always harbor grouse, but one day last winter, after a deep, soft snow, I could find neither a grouse nor a track of one. I had about concluded that my birds had moved out when my dog came to a point in the leafy top of an old oak blown down last summer. Three grouse flushed out one by one. There were no tracks under or near the down top. Obviously, these birds had flown in, but from where? Grouse must eat, especially in zero weather, so I examined the droppings for a clue. Among much unrecognizable debris, I found bud scales and also the tough yellow skins of frozen nightshade berries. In a thicket of young, soft maple I had noticed in summer, an abundant growth of nightshade. I went there, and after a search, found grouse tracks on a log. The birds had not waded the soft snow. They had walked the logs and picked the berries, projecting here and there within their reach. This was a quarter mile east of the down oak. That evening at sunset, I saw a grouse budding in a popple thicket a quarter mile west. There were no tracks. This completed the story. These birds, for the duration of the soft snow, were covering their home range a wing, not a foot, and the range was half a mile across. Science knows little about home range, how big it is at various seasons, what food and cover it must include, when and how it is defended against trespass, and whether ownership is an individual, family, or group affair. These are the fundamentals of animal economics, or ecology. Every farm is a textbook on animal ecology. Woodsmanship is the translation of the book. And the next part of the December chapter is called Pines Above the Snow. Acts of creation are ordinarily reserved for gods and poets, but humbler folk may circumvent this restriction if they know how. To plant a pine, for example, one need be neither god nor poet, one need only own a shovel. By virtue of this curious loophole in the rules, any clodhopper may say, "Let there be a tree, and there will be one." If his back be strong and his shovel sharp, there may eventually be 10,000. And in the seventh year he may lean upon his shovel and look upon his trees and find them good. God passed on his handiwork as early as the seventh day, but I notice he has since been rather noncommittal about its merits. I gather either that he spoke too soon, or that trees stand more looking upon than do fig leaves and firmaments. Why is the shovel regarded as a symbol of drudgery? Perhaps because most shovels are dull. Certainly all drudges have dull shovels, but I am uncertain which of these two facts is cause and which effect. I only know that a good file, vigorously wielded, makes my shovel sing as it slices the mellow loam. I am told there is music in the sharp plane, the sharp chisel, and the sharp scalpel, but I hear it best in my shovel. It hums in my wrists as I plant a pine. I suspect that the fellow who tried so hard to strike one clear note upon the harp of time chose too difficult an instrument. It is well that the planting season comes only in spring, for moderation is best in all things, even shovels. During the other months, you may watch the process of becoming a pine. The pine's new year begins in May, when the terminal bud becomes the candle. Whoever coined that name for the new growth had subtlety in his soul. The candle sounds like a platitudinous reference to obvious facts. The new shoot is waxy, upright, and brittle. But he who lives with pines know that candle has a deeper meaning, for at its tip burns the eternal flame that lights a path into the future. May after May, my pines follow their candles skyward, each headed straight for the zenith, and each meaning to get there if only there be years enough before the last trumpet blows. It is a very old pine who at last forgets which of his many candles is the most important, and thus flattens his crown against the sky. You may forget, but no pine of your own planting will do so in your lifetime. If you are thriftily inclined, you will find pines congenial company, for unlike the hand-to-mouth hardwoods, they never pay current bills out of current earnings. They live solely on their savings of the year before. In fact, every pine carries an open bank book in which his cash balance is recorded by 30 June of each year. If on that date his completed candle has developed a terminal cluster of 10 or 12 buds, it means that he has salted away enough rain and sun for a 2-foot or even a 3-foot thrust skyward next spring. If there are only 4 or 6 buds, his thrust will be a lesser one, but he will nevertheless wear that peculiar air that goes with solvency. Hard years, of course, come to pines as they do to men, and these are recorded as shorter thrusts, i.e., shorter spaces between the successive whorls of branches. These spaces, then, are an autobiography that he who walks with trees may read at will. In order to date a hard year correctly, you must always subtract 1 from the year of lesser growth. Thus, the 1937 growth was short in all pines. This records the universal drought of 1936. On the other hand, the 1941 growth was long in all pines. Perhaps they saw the shadow of things to come and made a special effort to show the world that pines still know where they are going, even though men do not. When one pine shows a short year, but his neighbors do not, you may safely interpolate some purely local or individual adversity, a fire scar, a gnawing meadow mouse, a wind burn, or some local bottleneck in the dark laboratory we call the soil. There is much small talk and neighborhood gossip among pines. By paying heed to this chatter, I learn what has transpired during the week when I am absent in town. Thus in March, when the deer frequently browse white pines, the height of the browsings tells me how hungry they are. A deer full of corn is too lazy to nip branches more than 4 feet above the ground. A really hungry deer rises on its hind legs and nips as high as 8 feet. Thus I learned the gastronomic status of the deer without seeing them, and I learned without visiting his field whether my neighbor has hauled in his corn shocks. In May, when the new candle is tender and brittle as an asparagus shoot, a bird alighting on it will often break it off. Every spring I find a few such decapitated trees, each with its wilted candle lying in the grass. It is easy to infer what has happened, but in a decade of watching I have never once seen a bird break a candle. It is an object lesson. One need not doubt the unseen. In June of each year, a few white pines suddenly show wilted candles, which shortly thereafter turn brown and die. A pine weevil has bored into the terminal bud cluster and deposited eggs. The grubs, when hatched, bore down along the pith and kill the shoot. Such a leaderless pine is doomed to frustration, for the surviving branches disagree among themselves who is to head the skyward march. They all do, and as a consequence, the tree remains a bush. It is a curious circumstance that only pines in full sunlight are bitten by weevils. Shaded pines are ignored. Such are the hidden uses of adversity. In October, my pines tell me, by their rubbed-off bark, when the bucks are beginning to feel their oats. A jack pine, about 8 feet high and standing alone, seems especially to incite in a buck the idea that the world needs prodding. Such a tree must, perforce, turn the other cheek also, and emerges much the worse for wear. The only element of justice in such combats is that the more the tree is punished, the more pitch the buck carries away on his not-so-shiny antlers. The chit-chat of the woods is sometimes hard to translate. Once in midwinter, I found in the droppings under a grouse roost some half-digested structures that I could not identify. They resembled miniature corn cobs about half an inch long. I examined samples of every local grouse food I could think of, but without finding any clue to the origin of the cobs. Finally, I cut open the terminal bud of a jack pine, and in its core I found the answer. The grouse had eaten the buds, digested the pitch, rubbed off the scales in this gizzard, and left the cob, which was in effect the forthcoming candle. One might say that this grouse had been speculating in jack pine futures. The three species of pine native to Wisconsin, red, white, and jack, differ radically in their opinions about marriageable age. The precocious jack pine sometimes blooms and bears cones a year or two after leaving the nursery, and few of my 13-year-old jacks already boast of grandchildren. My 13-year-old reds first bloomed this year, but my whites have not yet bloomed. Were it not for this wide diversity in social outlook, my red squirrels would be much curtailed in their bill of fare. Each year in midsummer, they start tearing up jack pine cones for the seeds, and no Labor Day picnic ever scattered more hulls and rinds over the landscape than they do. Under each tree, the remains of their annual feast lie in piles and heaps. Yet there are always cones to spare, as attested by their progeny popping up among the goldenrods. Few people know that pines bear flowers, and most of those who do are too prosy to see in this festival of bloom anything more than a routine biological function. All disillusioned folks should spend the second week in May in a pine woods, and such as wear glasses should take along an extra handkerchief. The prodigality of pine pollen should convince anyone of the reckless exuberance of the season, even when the song of the kinglet has failed to do so. Young white pines usually thrive best in the absence of their parents. I know of whole woodlots in which the younger generation, even when provided with a place in the sun, is dwarfed and spindled by its elders. Again, there are woodlots in which no such inhibition obtains. I wish I knew whether such differences lie in tolerance in the young, in the old, or in the soil. Pines, like people, are choosy about their associates and do not succeed in suppressing their likes and dislikes. Thus, there is an affinity between white pines and dewberries, between red pines and flowering spurge, between jack pines and sweet fern. When I plant a white pine in a dewberry patch, I can safely predict that within a year he will develop a husky cluster of buds, and that his new needles will show that bluish bloom which bespeaks health and congenial company. He will outgrow and outbloom his fellows planted on the same day, with the same care, in the same soil, but in the company of grass. In October, I like to walk among these blue plumes rising straight and stalwart from the red carpet of dewberry leaves. I wonder whether they are aware of their state of well-being. I know only that I am. Pines have earned the reputation of being evergreen by the same device that governments use to achieve the appearance of perpetuity, overlapping terms of office. By taking on new needles on the new growth of each year and discarding old needles at longer intervals, they have led the casual onlooker to believe that needles remain forever green. Each species of pine has its own constitution, which prescribes a term of office for needles appropriate to its way of life. Thus, the white pine retains its needles for a year and a half, the red and jack pines for 2 years and a half. Incoming needles take office in June, and outgoing needles write farewell addresses in October. All write the same thing in the same tawny yellow ink, which by November turns brown. Then the needles fall and are filed in the duff to enrich the wisdom of the stand. It is this accumulated wisdom that hushes the footsteps of whoever walks under pines. It is in midwinter that I sometimes glean from my pines something more important than woodlot politics and the news of the wind and weather. This is especially likely to happen on some gloomy evening when the snow has buried all irrelevant detail and the hush of elemental sadness lies heavy upon every living thing. Nevertheless, my pines, each with its burden of snow, are standing ramrod straight, rank upon rank, and in the dusk beyond I sense the presence of hundreds more. At such times I feel a curious transfusion of courage. And that's the end of the Pines Above the Snow part of the December chapter of A Sand County Almanac, The Words of Aldo Leopold. I, this spring, sat near some white pines on a windy day, and when every gust of wind came through, the air above me filled with yellow pollen blowing. It was a beautiful thing. I will never forget it. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thank you for listening.